are a consequence of underlying structures that enable these things to happen. And you can't have any sort of functional humanitarianism without political systems that are driven by a set of values and principles, and that we apply consistently across settings, not just when it's politically and economically convenient. There are obligations under international humanitarian law that ensure the safety of healthcare workers, the safety of unhindered humanitarian access, including the delivery of food. But at the moment, over 8 million people in Sudan face emergency or famine level food insecurity, according to the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, the IPA classification system.
And Dr. Tania Haj Hassan, I mean, you pointed out that in the place that you're in, where you worked, that's actually the agricultural center, and yet children were so severely malnourished. We only have 20 seconds.
Yeah, no, that's true and very shocking. And I think Professor Alec Duval sort of pointed to some of the structural reasons why that's the case. You know, people can be very poor with very little access to resources that are at, you know, arm's reach, as we've heard a lot over the last 2 years in conflicts throughout the world. And that's why
Dr. Tania Haj Hassan, I'm so sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Tania Haj Hassan and Alex Duval, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation. And that does it for today's show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org.
You are now listening to Mini Culture Presents here on KFEI 90.3 FM in these Twin Cities. My name is Michael Whetstone, and I'd like to begin by giving tremendous thanks to everyone who donated during the pledge drive. Your generosity keeps the lights on here and helps us to keep this community growing. You make it happen, and you are much appreciated. If you missed making a pledge during the recent member drive, it is not too late. Please consider doing so now by visiting KFEI.org and making a donation to True People-Powered Public Radio today. KFEI continues to operate thanks to your generous and vital support. You can easily make a secure and safe donation at our website. Just visit KFEI.org and click Donate. You will see the button in the upper right-hand corner of your browser. It has a little red heart next to the word donate, and that is because we love our benefactors and are grateful for your generosity. Thank you. First up today on Mini Culture Presents, we are going to air another episode of the Mini Culture Podcast from Season 9. KFAI producer John Gwynn tells us the story of the M.A. Gedney Pickling Company. Plus, later on in the show, we're going to hear a number of recent stories from the Mini Culture Collective on a wide variety of Minnesota-centric topics. We'll learn about dome cities, little libraries, the Aurora Borealis, empowering dancers, and daily prayers in stories from Allison Young, Rob McGinley Myers, Arme Vervard, Britt Amet, and Sheila Regan. So stick around for that. But first, here is the Mini Culture Podcast, Season 9, Episode 5, Bring Me Your Cucumbers, by producer John Gwynn.
Welcome to Mini Culture, the podcast where we explore the people, stories, and cultural phenomena that make Minnesota, well, Minnesota. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. Pickles are eaten all over the world, but there's something special about enjoying one here in the Midwest. From eating them on a stick at the fair to ordering a round of fried wedges for the table, Minnesotans find many creative ways to enjoy these briny treats. But pickles, and more specifically, cucumbers, are not native to Minnesota. It wasn't until a man named Matthias Gedney convinced farmers across Minnesota to grow a lot of cucumbers that Minnesota started producing pickles. Producer John Gwynn tells the story of the M.A. Gedney Pickling Company and its impact on our state.
In 1880, Minneapolis was bursting at the seams. The population grew 10 times over in just 20 years, from 13,000 to 165,000 residents. Much of the riverfront area was dominated by mills, with the flour mills downtown below the falls and the large lumber mills and train yards upstream above the falls. Many newcomers were arriving, among them a New Jersey native of Scottish heritage who came to town on the recently completed Milwaukee Road Railway with his wife and seven children. His plan? To start a pickle and condiment company. His name was Matthias Anderson Gedney. Born in Paterson, New Jersey in 1822, he had already lived a colorful life, working as a sailor on merchant ships by the age of 14. He even sailed around Cape Horn to get in on the California Gold Rush. Some monetary gains in this endeavor had brought him enough money to marry, and he moved his family to Evanston, Illinois, where he began working for Northwestern Pickle Works. Matthias was ambitious, loved pickles, and was soon eager to start his own company.
He went to work in Chicago for the Squire M. Dingy Pickle Company.
That was Jeff Tuttle, a fifth-generation descendant of Matthias Gedney.
And learned how to do that, knew that there was no pickle works in the upper Midwest, so he moved to Minnesota to do the same thing.
Matthias set out on horseback, accompanied by his two adult sons, Charles and John. They rode across a prairie landscape of corn, potatoes, wheat, and oats to convince farmers to try growing cucumbers, which were not considered a viable crop option in the upper Midwest. According to Jeff's brother, Carl Tuttle,
the theory was that it was too far north to grow cucumbers, but he convinced some farmers to try it, and it worked.
There was plenty of space to farm since the federal government had coerced indigenous communities to give up their land in the Treaty of Traverse des Sioux in 1851. The Dakota were confined to tiny parcels along the Minnesota River, while most of the land was occupied by settlers looking to farm. Matthias offered those settler farmers something they needed, a way to make money in the off-season.
It also bridged the gap between the corn being planted and being harvested. They had to invest in the seed for the corn, and then there was no cash flow until it got harvested in late September or whatever. And so from July till end of August, they got money coming in from the pickles. That was an incentive for them to keep doing it.
With enough farmers finding success growing cucumbers, in 1881, Matthias and his sons opened their first pickle and condiment production plant in North Minneapolis on Lowry Avenue along the Mississippi River. The air in the neighborhood, perfumed by the aroma of freshly cut pine lumber and the smell of wood smoke from the steam plant of the Northland Pine Company sawmill, was now infused with the smell of pickle brine. The Gedneys began delivering and selling their products to groceries in Minneapolis directly from horse-driven wagons. Here's Jeff Tuttle again.
The way that food got to the stores back then was much more direct. So everybody had a cash wagon that was, you know, selling cereal or selling cucumbers or whatever.
Grocery stores in those days kept large, open pickle barrels where customers just scooped out what they wanted onto a piece of wax paper.
They clearly sold a lot of Gedney pickle barrels full of pickles to the deli sections or something. Yeah.
It turns out that Matthias Gedney's pickle recipes were popular with the public. In just a few years, by the mid-1890s, annual production had grown to more than 30,000 barrels. Another plant was opened in St. Paul. In 1905, as the company was in preparations to celebrate 25 years in business, Matthias Anderson Gedney passed away, leaving control of the company to his son, Dode. The metropolitan area was expanding, and farms near the cities were being replaced by urban sprawl. So the Gedney Company built salting stations in various rural Minnesota towns located on rail lines, places like Annandale, Kimball, Eden Valley, Dassel, and Cokato. This way, they could start the brining process as soon as the crop was harvested.
Oh, the farmer is the man who feeds them all.
Harvesting cucumbers can be done a few different ways, according to Carl Tuttle.
It was very labor intensive, and there were machines that could harvest cucumbers, but it was only large cucumbers, and then the vine would be ejected out the back of the machine. They went through once, and that was it.
So the company promoted hand harvesting by their many contract farmers. In Silver Lake, Minnesota alone, over 120 families had signed up to grow cucumbers for Gedney. Silver Lake resident Jane Brinkman remembers how her family got involved.
We didn't have a lot of money because farming wasn't very lucrative at that time. So the next door neighbors would pick pickles and turn in the pickles. And my mom went over to visit one day. And next thing you know, we are planting pickles and harvesting them for money.
The company had selected a particular variety of seed to be planted by all of its growers, usually in late May. Gary Elfstrand of Annandale had a great-grandfather who was an early employee of the M.A. Gedney Pickling Company. He managed the pickle salting station in Annandale.
The crop itself was picked mainly by children because it was such backbreaking work for adults. The kids were built closer to the ground.
The Brinkmans and other contract farmers planted a few acres of cucumbers and paid their children to pick them every morning all summer long.
And after we were done picking, the highlight was loading them in the pickup and driving them 2 miles to the Pagan place where he would grade and price what he would give us for our pickles. It was all based on size. You know how when you're coming off of Highway 7 and you take that little road and then turn on the gravel road? It was right there that the pickle grading place was.
During harvest time in July and August, the plant ran around the clock on 3 shifts. About half of Gedney's annual output of pickles would be packed in late summer.
There were like 4 ladies that did the sorting on a slow-moving conveyor, so they preferred, which was generally 4.5 inches or less.
Now, you better have watched and got every pickle, because the small ones were the ones that you got the real lot of money for from Gedney.
And so in many cases, they would save that money and then they would buy the kids clothes and shoes and supplies for school. It was kind of their crop.
With that money, my mom was very diligent. She would buy us all school clothes and school supplies and a new pair of shoes. And if there was anything left, we could get one thing. Well, I remember one year we got the 39-cent bike mirror. You put it on your handlebars and it's a big mirror that you could see behind you.
In Silver Lake and Annandale and other farming communities, once the brining process was completed, the cucumbers were rinsed and loaded into barrels for delivery to the Gedney plant in Minneapolis or to a new facility that had been opened in the town of Chaska, a good 30 miles from downtown Minneapolis.
That's very nice. That's cool.
In 1945, upon Dode Gedney's passing, the top job at the company passed to son-in-law Harry Tuttle. As post-war America boomed, more roads were being built and trucks brought the cucumbers into the plant rather than the railroad. More innovations were arriving to the pickle industry as well. According to Jeff Tuttle, this was called the fresh pack process.
Taking fresh cucumbers, putting them right in the jar with vinegar, and then pasteurizing them to stabilize them.
Making sure the cucumbers were fresh was crucial to the process.
We were also pretty meticulous about maintaining the time that the fresh cucumbers would sit on the dock or sit in wait to get into the product, because that was a big differentiator too in terms of the sort of crispness and the quality of the pickle. It's how long it got warmed up at the outside temperatures.
In 1958, Gedney's entire operation was consolidated at the facility in Chaska, where a new 50,000-square-foot warehouse, plant, and office facility was built on an 18-acre site. However, things were changing. Fewer local growers and the popularity of fresh-packed pickles resulted in many of the salting stations across Minnesota being shuttered. In 1967, Carl and Jeff's father, Gedney Tuttle, was named company president.
At a fairly young age, he was in a management meeting where his father was as well, Harry Tuttle. And in that meeting, without warning, Harry announced, "Gedney, you're going to be the president now."
Gedney, named with the family surname, had been working for the firm since the late 1940s. Competition from other growing pickle brands such as Vlasic out of Detroit and Clausen out of Chicago were providing pressure on the company to keep innovating. Gedney Tuttle was up for the challenge.
Quality was definitely something that my father was very concerned about, and he was sort of a student of the emerging quality movement in the 70s, coming out of Japan and all that kind of stuff. And that's why the lab was a very important part of the business.
The lab that Carl Tuttle is referring to was the Pickle Laboratory, an important part of the plant in Chaska. The technician's work involved controlling the crunchiness of the pickles.
Press this spring-loaded plunger down that had a dull end on the pickle, and eventually it would pop through the skin. And that's where the number would read, at what point it popped through. And so you get an idea of how thick the skin was.
In addition to the quality control, Gedney Tuttle was leading some notable marketing efforts as well.
Gedney, it's a Minnesota pickle. Get me a Gedney, it's a Minnesota pickle.
Our dad hired this woman, Sandy Buchholz. They picked the jingle because it was a good balance of catchy but annoying.
The company began identifying itself as the Minnesota Pickle and partnered with the Minnesota State Fair. Gedney marketed them as the State Fair Pickle Line. Photographs of the winning pickle makers were featured on the packaging and in ads, and the company worked with them to ensure that their recipes were faithfully recreated.
Let's take the winning recipes from people who really love these things and sell them.
I have been named the best canner of the whole shebang 11 times, which is 8 times more than the second next person's.
This is Barbara Schaller of Burnsville, whose bread and butter pickles have won 12 blue ribbons over the years she's been submitting to the Minnesota State Fair.
In 1983, I won my first blue ribbons, and I always tell everybody, I said, there's nothing like success to encourage a person. And it was a harmless way to give me something to do and keep me from causing any trouble anywhere else.
Besides winning blue ribbons for her pickles, Barb Schaller's Peach Melba Jelly was also a smashing success that Gedney sold in stores. First, they had to get the recipe right.
Because the singing commercial that we all did said, made from our recipes.
Gedney has a brand new State Fair jam.
You'll love it.
And that's God's truth. I had tasted, I think, 3 different versions of the peach raspberry before I said, yes, that tastes like the one that I made.
Gedney, prize-winning State Fair jam.
I feel like I'm part of the Jam Hall of Fame.
Over the next several years, sales of the State Fair Blue Ribbon varieties continued to grow. Keeping up with changing tastes by rolling out new products was key to Gedney's success. Pickle planks, pickle pickups, refrigerated crispy pickles, and the spicy zingers. As the 2000s rolled around, further changes in the food business, agriculture, and the population of Minnesota were making it hard for small businesses to succeed. And Gedney Pickles was no exception. Family farms in Minnesota had declined by more than one-third over the past 40 years.
Farmers in Minnesota were backing away in droves from growing cucumbers. And so we started using Mexican cucumbers a lot more.
Labor shortages at the plant in Chaska were also occurring.
There were a lot of fairly menial tasks that needed to be done, sorting cucumbers, putting them in the jars and that kind of stuff. And people really didn't want to do that. Our own workforce that we'd had there was aging and retiring. That was becoming a real challenge.
Hard to source cucumbers. Nobody to come in and work at the plant. And that wasn't all.
There was also an environmental push to stop putting salt into the Minnesota River. It was looming as a threat to the existence of the company because they're called salt tanks. And every year we empty them out into this holding pond. The bacteria in the pond cleans the water, but it's still got salt in it. That has to go into the Minnesota River. We had a permit to do that, but that was becoming more and more at risk. That was an issue too.
And so it all came to a head, and the Tuttle brothers decided it was time. In 2009, Gedney Pickles was sold to a California company called PMC Global Incorporated. They are still producing Gedney pickles and using some of founder Matthias Gedney's original recipes to this day. The company has only 3 employees left in the state of Minnesota. Pickle making in Minnesota is far from over. In recent years, more and more do-it-yourself home canners are selling their wares, like the pickle enthusiasts that the Gedney Company would support at the state fair back in the day.
But in some ways, that sort of was a precursor to what's happening now with sort of artisan pickles reemerging.
Cassie Whipperfirth is a small farmer and pickle maker in Afton, where she says people are going back to the old way of growing and making their own food.
And I've been noticing that over the last couple of years. There's a lot of different food stands that are popping up all throughout this community. And I'm just trying to create a little farmer's market every day.
Cassie started her own cottage food industry under the name Rebel Pickle.
Not coming from a farming background myself, I wanted to do something that was a little bit different, a little bit rebellious. Not just the plain dill pickle, but we do a lot of different kind of pickles here.
She, along with other small farmers and home canners in Minnesota's cottage food industry, are bringing fresh flavors and new recipes to people's kitchen tables.
Just to create something new and to have something new in your fridge that you may not see all the time, that you may not find at the store. One of the things that we did was we pickled watermelon rinds and just something fun. That's one of the things about this area that I love is so many people are wanting to share what they know and the things that they have and say, oh, you should try this and then you should tell me what you think of it. So it really is a community. It really is an agriculture community that's trying to help each other build.
Back in North Minneapolis, the original Gedney Pickle Company plant is now rented out as artist studios. The Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board has a vision for that part of the city, their Above the Falls development plan. For now, although Gedney pickles are no longer made in Minnesota, they are still known as the Minnesota Pickle, and you can still find them on your grocery shelves. The plant in Chaska was sold off, and the Tuttle brothers, fifth-generation descendants of M.A. Gedney, have moved on to other ventures. But, like a fine brine, the aroma lingers on. For KFAI, I'm John Gwynn.
This episode was written and produced by John Gwynn. Additional editing help by Mason Butler.
Support for Miniculture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This podcast is edited and executive produced by Julie Sinsula. More episodes are coming soon, so make sure you're subscribed to Miniculture wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. Thanks for listening.
Are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Compline has been observed by Benedictine monks since the 6th century. Compline is the closing service of the day, and it's filled with music, incense, candles, and communal prayer. It's a short but beautiful moment to let go of the day and prepare for the next. St. John the Evangelist Episcopal Church has been offering a Compline service every Thursday night, inviting people of all faiths to take part in its power. KFAI producer Allison Young shares this story.
It's 7 o'clock on a Thursday evening at St. John the Evangelist Episcopal Church in St. Paul. For Richard Gray, the director of music, this means one thing.
Incense. I personally love incense. The smell of it just brings me somewhere, and it lets me know we're at Compline.
Compline has been practiced by Benedictine monks for centuries. It's part of the daily office, or mini services that are chanted and sung at prescribed hours, giving a prayer-like rhythm to the day. Richard Gray finds Compline one of the most meaningful. Derived from the Latin word for completion, Compline is the final of the offices, a moment of stillness and reflection before resting at the end of the day.
When you walk in to a Compline service, you won't see all the lights turned on in the sanctuary, but you'll also see a lot of candles lit. And that's to have a bit of a certain inviting atmosphere where things are just a little bit more calm. There's a mystery to that.
At St. John's, the gathering is unlike any other regular church service. It's less a performance and more about simply being within the sound and the silence, as well as the mystery.
That's like a really hard thing for people to do right now.
It's a very hard thing for people to do right now. And that's one of the things I really like about this service, is that moment, or those moments of stillness that we have an opportunity to take part of in the midst of this so busy, totally busy life and all the noise that's around us. This service offers us a chance to put that aside and not be in that for a little while. Veni Sancte Spiritus,
et emite... You're hearing the Mirandola Ensemble singing, a quartet that regularly provides music for Compline at St. John's. Their focus is on early music, which is mostly sung a cappella or without instrumental accompaniment. This type of ancient music is ideal for the Compline service because it's intimate with a mystical quality, according to the artistic director of the Mirandola Ensemble, Nick Chalmers.
It's all music that's produced by our bodies. In order for just one note or one chord to sound, everyone has to first of all be quiet and then all focus on the same thing, each other's breath. They all inhale together at the same time, ideally quietly. And then they all come in together at the exact same time, singing the exact same vowel in balance with one another, and they create a chord. I mean, just that, which occupies 1 second, that's like a miracle to me.
Compline has been practiced regularly since the 6th century and offers an intense feeling of peace that somehow we are not alone in life. But this hunger for peace, plus rest and trust, is not exclusive to the Christian faith. Jewish custom is to use the contemplative and focused prayer of Amidah to close the day, while Muslims pray the Isha. But even the secular practice of counting up what we're grateful for before we sleep captures the spirit of Compline.
It's just a time where people that are not necessarily like-minded in the world can come together and experience something together that's beautiful and that's peaceful. And that, I think, was probably true 50 years ago and 500 years ago, but it seems especially true now.
While Compline is filled with singing and chanting, there is also a decisive period called the Great Silence. Signaled by a gong at its beginning and end, nothing is meant to happen in these 60 seconds but quiet and togetherness.
It's a very powerful moment. And one of the things I love is, you know, I close my eyes, but sometimes I'll open them briefly just to sort of look around the room. And especially to those who are coming for the first time, to see how they're experiencing this moment of silence.
Do not ask anxiously, what are we to eat? What are we to drink? What shall we wear? The whole world runs after such things. So do not be anxious about tomorrow. Today has enough problems of its own. Tomorrow can look after itself.
In Compline, participants recite together a statement to not worry about what comes next, because there are enough problems right now. This can mean a variety of things, depending on how you interpret it. Perhaps it's a call to have faith that things will work out, or a reminder that problems will always arise in life, so there's no use in worrying about them.
That text is sort of a grounding text for us to sort of sit in time and acknowledge that we have permission to leave things behind and start a new day tomorrow. before we go to sleep and go to bed.
For KFAI, I'm Allison Young.
Tuned into Mini Culture Presents KFAI Sound and Documentary Showcase program. At the top of the show, we heard season 9 of the Mini Culture podcast, episode 5, Bring Me Your Cucumbers by producer John Gwynn. Come back next week for another installment. But if you can't wait that long, subscribe to the podcast and hear all great 8 seasons of this award-winning Minnesota-centric show. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And as promised, I've got a batch of Mini Culture stories for you right around the corner about domed cities, little libraries, the Aurora Borealis, and empowering dancers in stories from Rob McGinley Myers, Arme Brevard, Britt Ahmet, and Sheila Reagan. Coming up after the break.
Tune in on Tuesday, October 7th for 24 hours of special programming, KFAI's Celebrating Latina Culture, featuring all of your favorite KFAI Latina programming, as well as emerging voices coming from the Twin Cities local Latina community. It starts at midnight on Tuesday, October 7th. Your favorite Tuesday regular programming will return on October 14th. A schedule will be posted online at kfai.org.
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue, presenting Jonathan Richman live on stage Thursday, October 16th. Singer-songwriter Jonathan Richman has come a long way since founding the proto-punk band Modern Lovers. But his songs have rippled through popular music, influencing some of the biggest names in pop and rock. He's touring with his latest release, Only Frozen Sky Anyway, and his appearance will feature Tommy Larkins on drums. More information about Jonathan Richman live at First Avenue is available at first-avenue.com.
And you are listening to Mini Culture Presents here on Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Radio Without Boundaries. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members just like you.
You are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. The Northern Lights have been visible to Minnesotans at several points this spring and summer. KFAI's Arme Brevard traveled up to Sandstone, Minnesota to see them one night in May. She shares her experience in this story.
A late spring frost had knocked the mosquitoes out for the night, providing a welcome respite. We could enjoy a peaceful evening from being mobbed by the forest paparazzi. Hallelujah! The wood tick community, on the other hand, were unrelenting. The mild winter had provided the perfect breeding ground for the creepy little blood-sucking crawlies, and I could feel one crawling up my leg from the inside of my jeans as we sat around the campfire watching the night sky in anticipation of a light show. The hubbub that got me out of the Twin Cities for the night was that the latest series of mega solar flares would provide us with the perfect opportunity to catch the Northern Lights, which, by the way, were still on my bucket list. With all the camping trips my family have been on to the northernmost state parks of Minnesota, I had yet to see the Aurora Borealis. So, cozy in the woodlands just outside of Sandstone, Minnesota, I had a better than average chance of seeing them. Sandstone is about an hour and a half northeast of the Twin Cities, just past Hinckley on Highway 35W. The town is bordered by the Kettle River and is surrounded by Banning State Park. for the bicycle enthusiasts, is a connection to the Willard Munger Bicycle Trail that ends in Duluth. The city's name in Ojibwe translates to "at the quarrying place" due to the sandstone quarry the city was built around. Now then, 9 p.m. became 10 p.m. and the stars filled the sky above the bare trees. Keep in mind it's early May. There was only a fingernail moon to compete with the multitude of stars and the ambiance of the campfire. We shared our latest tick counts and took turns telling nonsensical stories as we watched for changes to the night sky. Someone made a comment about the coyote spring ritual, and we all listened. Then silently gave thanks for the company of others around the fire on this cool spring night. You know, there's safety in numbers. The auroras had appeared the night before and were amazing, with multiple colors streaming across the horizon, but I had been in the cities and missed the event. So bragging rights were established as my fellow campers shared their aurora stories and passed cell phones displaying pictures of colored lights painting the night sky as we waited in anticipation of a repeat performance. I was the only new addition to the spectators around the campfire and felt like the fisherman whose catch had slipped off its hook. So I was more than ready for a light show. Hey, there's the Big Dipper. All eyes were back on the night sky and off from the cell phones. I see Polaris, another voice chimed in, as another added, isn't that the North Star? Polaris is the North Star, right? We all scanned the sky for easy-to-identify star clusters. I counted on my fingers what I could identify and decided a trip to the Bell Museum's planetarium just made my summer to-do list. It would be well worth my while to visit for a refresher on the seasonal constellations. A star creased across the sky, followed by another in hot pursuit. Shooting stars! Hoots went up by those who caught the chase, silencing the coyote's weird yipping for a short moment, and more shooting stars followed the leader. I made a wish on one of them. Hey, check out those lights. What do you think? UFO? Too fast for a plane. We grouped gazed the sky following the movement. It was a bit fast even for Superman. UFO sighting stories sprung out of the most unlikely campers as the minutes ticked closer to the 11 o'clock hour. Finally, green streaks began appearing. Faint, barely perceptible. Unimpressed, I thought, what? So this is it? Collectively, the group strayed away from the fire circle of chairs to an open area by the pond, just a hop, skip, and a jump away for a better view. We watched as the invisible dimmer switch expanded the faint streaks into well-defined bands of luminous green that cast light bright enough to give us aurora shadows. Now that was impressive. The forest was silent. Even the coyotes were speechless as the whole area was engulfed in this otherworldly glow under a canopy of brilliant emerald green. The aurora began to shimmer and breathe. The expanding and contracting was mesmeric. The videos I had seen hadn't captured this proof of life. I truly felt I was witnessing the planet as a living entity. So awestruck and speechless, I watched the aurora peak, then slowly fade to a memory. We disbanded in reverence of what we had just witnessed, and when I checked the time, it was well past midnight and getting colder.
Listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI has been provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website by visiting kfai.org/minneculture.
Picture this. A domed city with conveyor belt sidewalks and self-driving cars, all in the middle of the Minnesota wilderness. Does this futuristic city sound like science fiction to you? Well, it almost became a reality in 1973. Athelson Spillhouse, a former dean of technology at the University of Minnesota, had $1 million of seed funding to lay the groundwork for a utopian city in northern Minnesota. So why didn't it become a reality? KFAI's Britt Ahmed tells this story of Spillhouse and the Minnesota experimental city.
Athelstan Spillhouse couldn't wait for the future. It was February 1969, and the scientist, inventor, and former dean at the University of Minnesota's Institute of Technology stood before an audience declaring, "I'm living in the 21st century right now. We must join together to try to invent the future.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the..."
By the end of the year, America would put men on the moon. It felt like the pulpy science fiction stories of the 1950s were about to come true. Families hopping rockets to vacation on Mars, robots serving cocktails aboard space liners. Spillhouse himself was optimistic about the future and almost viral in his ability to infect others with his belief that technology could create a better world.
The model of a new town as it might be.
Which probably explains why, in 1973, a mere 4 years later, he had convinced the Minnesota legislature to get behind a project that today sounds impractical, if not a little naive. A planned city of 250,000 plunked in the middle of nowhere and engineered from its inception to avoid the diseases of contemporary 20th century cities like poverty, homelessness, pollution, traffic, crime. Spillhouse would call it the Minnesota Experimental City, MXC for short, and it would be located on 74,000 acres in northern Minnesota's Aiken and Cass counties. This was news to Terry Madrick, who in 1973 was a young math teacher at a school in Aiken County. He'd never heard of the scientist with a funny name or about his scheme for a city of tomorrow.
He really was the brainchild behind attempting to create a city, a major city, completely from scratch.
What dumbfounded Madrick most about the proposal?
The city center was supposed to be under a dome. I mean, it was ridiculous. It was like a mile in diameter, but that would have been the center. But out from that, there would still be city, but it just wouldn't be under the dome. They had what was called a buffer zone.
Because the dome city would be carved out of wilderness, it would need to create its own infrastructure. A lot of that would reside in the buffer zone.
Nowhere in the city would they allow traffic. Back then, they were talking about parking in big ramps on the outskirts. You'd go from there into the inner city by movable sidewalks. They wanted the city to be self-sufficient. That meant there would be spaces in there for growing food.
Of course, cropland would be limited under the dome.
So the food and so forth would have had to have been grown in like high-rise greenhouses. But that's also where they'd put cattle in high-rise barns. To any farmer that knows anything about anything, that would have been a joke.
The corporations and donors who coughed up $1 million+ to get the ball rolling didn't think so. The MXC board was given the green light. And this was a problem for Madrick, whose neighbor had informed him early on that her property and his would be bulldozed for the buffer zone.
At first, I thought it was a joke. I said, there's just no way you're going to build a city here. Probably 30-40% of what they were looking at is swampland. Well, you can't build a city on swampland.
But the promise of utopia was too enticing for the backers of the MXC to give up over practical concerns. So Madrick and his neighbors organized and took their concerns to the Minnesota legislature. This foolishness would impact their homes, their lives, and nobody ever asked them if they wanted a city built on top of them. But the MXC board was already looking forward to the 1976 groundbreaking, and it seemed to Madrick that many of the legislators seemed either unaware of the project or uninterested in what he had to say. This was how it was going to end. Fortunately, the neighbors had one more ace up their sleeve
a meeting with the Pollution Control Agency. Madrick spoke at the meeting and called on the agency's sense of fairness.
I said, if the will of the people means a damn thing anymore, you know, that you will take all this in consideration.
The citizens had spoken, and the agency was actually listening. They cited concerns that the MXC would be a potential environmental nightmare. That decision came as the legislature woke to another looming disaster.
We're talking billions of dollars back then to have this built.
$10 billion, in fact. Way too much. But Terry Madrick believes the Minnesota Experimental City's grand design doomed the project from the beginning.
A glass dome of some kind, a clear dome, a mile in diameter to a 300 yards high, that's practically an impossible task today, let alone in the 70s.
Undeterred, Athelstan Spillhouse tried to get a dome city in Ohio and in Virginia, but those plans fizzled out too. So he moved to a quieter life on the East Coast, where the self-described retired genius devoted himself to his antique toy collection. But when he died in 1998, obituaries remembered not just a scientist and inventor, but a visionary who had imagined a domed city in the wilds of Minnesota. This is Britta Ahmet for KFAI.
Miniculture on KFAI. A few years ago, reporter Rob McGinley Myers started to notice little free libraries cropping up in people's front yards. You've probably seen them around too, those tiny houses full of books that are free to borrow. The Little Free Library organization, which is headquartered in St. Paul, estimates that more than 150,000 of these little libraries have sprung up around the world in the past decade. Rob was curious about the people who ran the little libraries out of their front yards, so he started knocking on doors in his Como Park neighborhood of St. Paul, asking the little library owners to tell him how these libraries have changed their relationship to their neighborhoods.
Well, I'm Nick Keller.
My name is Val Cunningham.
I'm Kate McCray.
I'm Jennifer Dietrich.
I'm Sarah Lavat.
And I've had this little library for 4 years.
And I've had my little free library for the past 7 years.
For 7 years.
7 or 8 years.
Well, when was that? How many years ago was that?
Oh, for Pete's sake, who knows? How old are kids in first grade? I don't know. Do you remember?
And do you remember what the inspiration was for getting it?
Libraries have been always a huge part of my life, you know, the formal brick-and-mortar library. And my folks, when we were kids, we moved a ton, all the time, every year. And every new town we came to, my mom would take us to the library to get a card. And she always had a library card. And then to think of people being able to you know, have their own library and just get free books is just, to me, such a magical thing. So I am... A lot of people build their own, but I'm not handy. So I you can order them from the organization. That's what I did. Then a friend of mine dug a hole with a post hole digger and put in the post, and then it was a piece of cake to put this up. So, yeah, I just thought I got to have one.
The public library was about 4 blocks from our house, so I spent a lot of time at that library. It was kind of, I wasn't technically a latchkey kid, but that's kind of how I grew up, is my parents would, like, we, you know, we were feral then. We were running the neighborhoods. We were in the safe places back in the 80s. And I spent so much time at my library that I got to know the children's librarians in my public library so well. I would beep the books on my steps and pretend I was checking them out. So libraries have always been super close to me.
I work in the schools, so the reality of today's screens everywhere, I feel like books are, you know, sort of the antithesis, trying to kind of fight against kids getting, so we have two young boys being sucked into that all the time. It slows them down, lets the brain work in a different way.
I actually just stocked what's in there now, and I really strive to have a diverse collection, both in terms of cultures and in terms of ages. So I try to put board books in there, but I try to put books for senior citizens in there, bestsellers, non-bestsellers, local interests.
I also pull and rotate books, like, based on seasons. Like, if in July someone throws in a Christmas book for kids, I might take that out
and put it back in, like, closer to the holiday. Like, around Halloween, I try and have Halloween books for kids, too.
And you can see, somebody is always putting in kids' books, which is really cool, because there are a lot of kids on this block.
Yeah.
And they just love this idea of free books. So sometimes it gets a little thin, and then I go up to the Ramsey County Library on Hamlin, the big county library, and they have a really good book sale, you know, dollar for a hardback, and I'll get a batch and put them in here. And they're usually pretty good books.
Is there ever anything that shows up in the library that you don't want there?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes things will come in there and you realize that someone has just, like, Marie Kondo'd their entire kitchen, like, cookbook collection. Like, I came one morning and it was, like, packed to the gills with all these cookbooks from, like, the 1980s about microwave cooking and things. I was like, well, we can't really be just that. So I called through some of those.
It's a fine line, but I'm in charge. So I don't want to offend people. And if it's something that's, you know, you think yourself, well, somebody might be interested in this, I would leave it. I can't think, you know, if there was something that was very misogynistic, it would go in the trash. And a racist. Yeah, I have standards.
I think it's, you know, everybody's got a different view of the world. And I think that the little libraries are something that, this is like a microcosm of all those different views. I mean, I don't know, you get a sense of who's around you, I guess, when you have a little library.
People come in their cars and park and then bring a box of books up and put some in here. I've got some regulars. And then people that live on the block, and people are always checking. And you find out the funniest things, like my neighbor across the street. She's always looking for books about seafaring and ocean tales. Who would ever have thought that?
I was out shoveling one winter night. I love shoveling at night when it's just quiet and to get a head start on whatever huge storm we might have coming. And this guy walked by and he's like, is that your little library? Because I happen to be just a few steps down the block. And I said, yeah. And it was just a random in the middle of, you know, a snowstorm kind of question. He's like, oh, we love what we get from there. I bring my kids all the time.
So we got some. Damage,
yes,
from the last storm.
Was that the big storm?
That was the big storm.
Did it just rip the door right off?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think that it was left a bit ajar and somehow. Phew.
This is the second rendition because the first was victim to the elements.
After like 5 years, it got some carpenter ants in it, and so we had a big storm and it just kind of fell over, and that was the end of that.
I tried repainting it one time, and I'm not a good painter. Oh, this had to be repaired. I had a handyman repair this. The wood just deteriorated, and then I tried painting it, and yeah, I'm a very messy painter.
So this one was rebuilt on Mother's Day of 2016, and both Catherine and Anna wrote little,
aww,
little sweet messages. I know, right? So it's really special.
Well, and what's so beautiful is that the design of the outside of the library is like a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And then you open it up, and inside are these notes, these lovely Mother's Day notes from your daughters.
I don't know. I'm going to get teary reading these.
I know. I was going to ask you if you'd read them aloud, but I don't know.
Okay. One says, thank you, Mom, for giving me love. Love, Catherine. The other says, I don't know that I can describe you in one word, so I'll tell you a secret. Every time I see you, my heart is full of love for you. I love you, Mom, Anna. Okay.
Yeah.
Happy Mother's Day 2016.
That's amazing.
I don't know if people read those when they open the door.
I imagine they do.
Maybe they do. That's a pretty nice
view. I mean, this is the most personal little library I think I've seen in all of this, the ones that I've looked at.
Well, we're doing it right.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
This is Mini Culture on KFAI. A unique program aimed at supporting, celebrating, and empowering dancers celebrated 20 years in 2024. The program, called Solo, puts dancers in the driver's seat
as they imagine the possibilities of the forum. KFAI's Sheila Regan attended the 20th anniversary performance of Solo and shares this story.
They say you can hear the bombs. At least you know you're still alive.
At the O'Shaughnessy Auditorium in September, Layla Awadalla crouches on the floor, undulating her body. The dancer's new piece, made in collaboration with Lebanese choreographer Alexandre Polakevich, incorporates text by Awadalla responding to the war in Gaza.
I just want peace. I just want peace, says. I just want your bodies in peace, says. Your land in peace.
She doesn't move around the floor much, instead confining the dance to an area center stage. Behind her is a large box that functions like an acoustic bass body with four strings attached. When she slaps the strings, the instrument resonates like the sound of a bomb. Awadalla's performance was part of a biennial event called Solo, featuring recipients of the McKnight Fellowship for Dancers. The 20-year-old program pairs the awarded dancers with choreographers of their choosing.
And it's very validating and expansive for them to think about their role in that way.
That's Dana Castle, the program director for the McKnight Fellowship for Dancers. Castle says this opportunity for dancers to choose their choreographer is very unique.
It also often allows them to reach out to a choreographer that they've never had contact with or have had only minimal contact with, really have agency to create a deep connection with somebody that they've admired from afar sometimes, and to create a work together really in collaboration.
The McKnight Foundation began funding arts fellowships in 1982, but those were mainly focused on artists who were creators.
It didn't have any support for interpretive artists.
Neil Cuthbert, who joined McKnight in 1991 as its first fine arts program officer, was instrumental in the foundation expanding its support toward not just generative artists, but also dancers, musicians, and theater artists. Solo, which began 20 years ago, expanded on that idea.
And so to me, it was kind of like, well, we got to give them a chunk of money to commission something for themselves, for the dancers, and then do a performance of that. I mean, because it's just, it felt so obvious to me that you'd want to showcase the virtuosity of these dancers. And the first year it happened, it was a smash success, you know, it was a sellout crowd, and it just became that kind of a thing, you know, from there on out.
Aaron Thompson, a dancer, choreographer, and educator in the Twin Cities, participated in Solo that first year as a choreographer and has attended nearly every performance since.
And it's just been really interesting to see the choices that dancers have made.
Especially valuable was the opportunity for dancers to choose a choreographer and dance that might go against type.
The beauty of it is it's their choice, you know, and it's just awesome to see people doing something that we have not seen them do before.
Thompson also performed in a solo piece when she applied for the dance fellowship after working as a dancer for 50 years at the age of 64.
It felt like kind of coming full circle.
The anniversary performance spanned a range of styles and traditions, with each work highlighting the skills of the featured dancers.
So I wonder if anybody here has performed in a solo. Would you raise your hand high for me?
Alongside brand new works, dance fellow Sam Arrows Mitchell performed a restaged reconstruction of two pieces by Jose Limon. These were ritualistic percussive pieces. At times, Arrows Mitchell leapt across the stage like a deer in Limon's visceral choreography. Ballet dancer Yuki Takuda performed a heartbreaking send-up to the now-closed Cole Center for Dance and the Performing Arts. Takuda has a captivating presence, and you could almost imagine her looking up into the Cole Center's immense auditorium. Interspersed with the live performances were video snippets put together by Caitlin Hamill, a video artist who specializes in dance.
I got into filmmaking actually because of the solo concert.
Hamill has been an instrumental part of the solo program, beginning with a documentary she made with her father about solo back in 2008. In intervening years, Hamill has created short videos featuring interviews with solo artists along with rehearsal footage.
I live to dance, I dance to live.
For the 20th anniversary of the concert, Hamill also put together short clips from all the solo artists that have performed since 2004.
It's really moving. It's just incredible, and I've seen most of them in person.